This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
I wanted to congratulate Eben for he just opened a restaurant in JFK Terminal 4, like in it. And it's actually a good restaurant. It's by the people who did Red Rooster and Eben. So Eben would walk in with a pass every day, and now this restaurant is open, so you can have fine dining before you get treated like shit.
Great
on
cocktails.
Your intercontinental plane. Congratulations, Eben.
I mean, there's a lot to be congratulatory about. This is our final episode of this season of talk show here. We've kind of done them in a kind of organized fashion, which amazes me. But you know, congratulations to you, David, for. You're looking at an Obie winner, folks.
Well, I just really want to congratulate you on your airport.
I just want to congratulate you on your Obie.
Thank you. Congratulations on your airport.
Congratulations on your Obie.
Congratulations on your Obie.
Congratulations on your airport.
Okay, so for those of you who haven't seen this before, this is how the talk show works. We just invite people with interesting jobs. Interesting is very widely defined. The only thing excluded from the definition of interesting jobs is artists. We do not interview artists. In the middle of this, the format of the interviews is that I will interrogate our guests for about 10 to 15 minutes. Then you guys get to ask them questions for 10 to 15 minutes. Then we do a segment called Minor Obsessive, during which somebody who knows much too much about a given subject that is not their job will do a slide talk on that subject. Tonight's guest will be the inestimable Sina Najafi, the editor of Cabinet himself, who will be discussing umbrellas, which he knows much too much about. And during all of this madness, passion, and chaos, Eben will be wandering around dispensing cocktails to you, which he has invented specifically for this occasion. At a certain point, he will divulge the ingredients, and we will suggest names for said cocktail. And at the end of the show, having hopefully sampled enough of these cocktails, we will vote on the proposed names and decide one. So, without further ado, I would like to introduce our first guest. Congratulations on your airport.
Congratulations on your Obie.
Right. That didn't work. The other thing that always happens is that we're hopeless at monologues, and we keep trying to reinvent the monologue, or at least squirm out of it, if not reinvent it. And sometimes it works better than others. Meh. Last one of the season, you won't tell anybody. It was fun. Our first guest tonight is New York's executive director of bridge inspection and bridge management. We are very lucky to have Mr. Budget Aryanov. But mainly known as Yanov to eliminate mispronunciations, correct?
That's correct.
That's correct. So Yanov showed up a little bit early, and we asked him in passing what he thought of our bridge, this being the Union Street Bridge. It's over there. I'm also an inspector of bridge management, just not. And we sort of asked this idly. We weren't even sure if it was in his jurisdiction. And Yanov said, huh. Well, I'm a little early. I guess I should just go inspect it. So you may have noticed this very possibly picturesque, definitely fragrant drawbridge.
It's a bascular bridge.
It's a
bascular bridge with two leaves.
Bascular. How did it rate? How did it play out?
Tonight?
Yeah, how does it look?
It will last. It's due for replacement. And actually, the replacement, you may be among the first people from the general public to know what the replacement will look like. It will be very innovative. The consultant went out and thought of something original. This bascular bridge is the standard type with two leaves, opens like that. And actually the span, the canal, is not very wide. So the consultant said, we'll save some mechanics at the expense of some force. If we only have one leaf, the whole span will be just one leaf, will open on the opposite side. And for that, of course, we have to develop some more power on that particular side. So there will be a little bit of a tower there, and because the canal, the soil is not perfect, so it will have to be a little bit further inland. And then it will have an interesting shape, reminiscent of older bridges, but it will be one leaf. And they definitely, they sold us on it. I thought it was original. Other people from our agency liked it too. And that's how it's going to go eventually. So it will look different. It will still be a vascular bridge, but it will be one span, one leaf, and it will be a new thing.
Are you going to keep the incredibly cute little bridge house?
No, it's going to go.
It's going to go?
Absolutely.
No more bridge house?
No.
Okay. Now,
but on the other side, there will be a cuter, a bigger, and newer.
Bigger and cuter?
Yes.
You are innovative. But so you oversee something like 2,200 bridges, right? Or?
That is absolutely correct, but not all of us are city bridges. 2,200 is the total number. And that includes about 600 state bridges. All the bridges on the national highway system are considered to be state bridges. So much of the BQE, all of LIE, all of the Cross Bronx, including bridges that go over a state. Then there are the toll bridges, which are managed by the authorities. The Robert Moses authorities are still in charge. Anything that charges money is an authority bridge. And then there are 800 city bridges. And among them are 25 movable. And this union.
So you oversee the is my mic really loud and his mic's really soft? All right. So you oversee the 800 bridges.
About.
Yes. So with 800 bridges to oversee, how is your knowledge of the Union Street Bridge so ready to hand?
Well, I've been doing I'm in this job for 25 years, and I established it based on experience I had before that, and also it so happens I'm interested in the subject. But also, this all the movable bridges are special interest bridges. We only have 25 movable bridges, and they're more demanding than any other. So one smart thing to do about them is to just fix them, make them fixed, and save a lot of money.
But all the boat traffic in Gowanus, wouldn't that just wreck commerce?
Well, obviously, in some cases, it's not an option. For instance, on the Belt Parkway, there is the Mill Basin Bridge and the Perdigot Bridge. These were movable bridges, and we were rebuilding them. And we're just building them higher because it's possible. And they will not be movable anymore.
Okay.
Here it's not an option.
But is there anyone going through? I mean.
Yes, boats are, with very tall masts. There was this unique situation on East River, going under the Roosevelt Island Bridge. The Roosevelt Island Bridge is a lift bridge from Queens to the island. And a lift bridge, you want the deck to be relatively lighter, and one solution is to make it an open grating. It's problematic in many ways, but it's lighter, and it has the strength to carry the traffic. So there is this elegant yacht with a tall mast, fiberglass, of course, goes under the bridge going downstream. The mast hits the face of the bridge. The current carries the boat. And the mast now drags under the bridge and goes through the open grating. There is consternation in the traffic above. They close the bridge. There is this mast sticking up. Obscenely, perhaps. And then our bridge operators, who are immediately on the site, decide to lift the bridge and release the boat. Unfortunately, though, the mast is so stuck that they start dragging the boat upwards. So eventually the matter was resolved.
When did this happen?
This happened like 5 or so years ago. Very recent year. The most recent unpleasantness was on the Brooklyn Bridge last March.
You oversee the Brooklyn Bridge as well?
Oh, of course. The East River bridges are ours.
Lucky you. Okay.
You might well say that. I mean, the Brooklyn Bridge, there is a lot of work going on. And the contractor has a scaffolding, metal shielding kind of hanging under the bridge, and workers are actually walking on that shielding. It's tied to the bridge with ropes, and the deal is that they will only extend the scaffolding to mid-span from one side, and the navigation channel will be the other side. And then when they shift around, so will the navigation channel.
The what channel?
The navigation.
Okay.
And then this tugboat comes with a very tall barge with something on it, and it goes just like 10 feet the wrong side of mid-span and slices through this shielding, cuts it to ribbons, and this happens half an hour before the workers came. It was very fortunate. The guy had no idea what he had done. They caught up with him in Hoboken or somewhere, the coast guard. He didn't know. But we had, the police closed the whole bridge. And actually it turned out that the contractor had used perfect ropes to attach this shielding, because they had the strength to do the job, but as they got, the shielding got ripped, the ropes broke. And they did not cause any other damage to the bridge or anything. And the workers who were due to come to the site were not there yet, so it was a very happy close call. That was last March.
Do you pilot a boat as well? Do you know how to? Do you even care?
A boat? No.
No. They're just potential problems.
Well, bridge inspection uses sometimes boats, but I don't have to get involved with the boat.
But what's, say, like the biggest threat to a bridge? Is it boats? Is it cars? Is it
collision? Let me put it this way. I'm beginning to sound very specific now, almost like in my class at Columbia. But the thing is that New York State sat down very smartly and decided to identify vulnerabilities in general, like hypothetical almost. And now there are seven. Steel problems, concrete problems, water problems. Water problems are dominant.
Are what?
Hydraulic problems related to water. You put all other vulnerabilities together, and they don't match the number of problems arising from water. Now, earthquake is minuscule compared to water in bridge problems. But then there is also overload and collision. Now, if you heard about I-5 in Washington State...
I was going to ask you,
This was a collision. A truck took it down. It was a very unfortunate hit. I mean, I've seen now videos of the hit. And, I mean, the bridge was vulnerable to collision, and the truck managed to hit the exact one single spot, which there couldn't be a worse spot, because this was a simple span, what we call, going from here to here. The truck goes, and the bridge is stabilized by these portal frames that go over, and the truck hits exactly the middle one. So as this one collapses, the whole thing falls. The truck passes.
Oh, the truck passed?
Oh, yeah.
Like in a cartoon?
Yes.
So you're trained as an engineer, right?
I'm educated as an engineer.
You're educated as an engineer. And do you also teach bridge engineering or...
I teach at Columbia. Sometimes, I mean, since we're in Brooklyn, sometimes I actually teach at Brooklyn Poly too, but my regular class is Columbia.
And do you ever design bridges?
That was in the old days. I got sucked into inspection so much. Now I review designs. I make recommendations to designs, but I've not in the last 20 years been on a legitimate bridge design team.
Do you miss it?
Yeah, a little bit.
And so what does inspection entail?
Well, I got sucked into inspection, and it was a surprise to me. So everything is serendipitous. The most creative force in life is coincidence. So there was no other work in the mid-80s, and bridges were falling down at the time. They're not anymore. But so there was a lot of work in bridge inspection, and I realized that if I'm the designated bridge inspector, every bridge by law had to be inspected every 2 years at least. Maybe more, but at least every 2 years, every bridge needs to be inspected, and it's a federal mandate. And I realized that if I get the job to inspect the bridge, I actually own it. I actually end up knowing more about that bridge than the designer knew. And this proprietary feeling, I got used to it.
And so what is a typical inspection regime like?
Well, New York State goes a little further than others, but you have to be a licensed engineer in the state of New York. And you have to inspect every element in every span of the bridge. And to every element in every span of the bridge, you have to give a rating. And then you sign, and you put your engineering license on it, and between this and the next inspection, anything happens on the bridge, it's you.
Wow.
You get to like it, you know?
So far, your record is spotless.
Well, now I have sort of judiciously moved to supervising inspectors rather than I have to say, the practice in New York State is that consultants inspect bridges. So I used to work as a consultant, then I joined the city. The city did not, until 1989, the city did not have a bridge department. Somebody figured that, if you're in transportation and if you observe the New York network of vehicular transportation, you'll notice that there are a lot more roads than bridges. And so they said what we need is a road department. But then the roads did not collapse and the bridges did. So some administrators campaigned at the time. The really pivotal moment was when they closed the Williamsburg Bridge in 1988. I don't know if anybody recalls. But this was a bridge inspection, a standard bridge inspection, and they said, we're not sure if this bridge is safe. And they closed for anybody except pedestrians. And some administrators wisely saw this as an opportunity to impress the community with the need for a bridge department. And so such a department was established. That's when I joined. And then all these reports that I had generated the year before started coming to me.
And you had to sign off on your own.
Well, now I said, what was this inspector thinking, you know?
Awesome. How large is your staff now?
Well, that's a good question, because when I started, we were in pretty much in a state of panic in 1989-90. We were running after disasters. And I was budgeted for like 70 people in bridge inspection. But things have toned down because a lot of money was spent on rebuilding. I mean, like $500 to $600 million a year for many years. And so things are not as precarious now as they used to be. Like I see this bridge here, I tell you, you know, it will last until it gets replaced. So I have 30 people.
And how long does it take to inspect something like the Brooklyn Bridge or the Williamsburg Bridge?
The Brooklyn Bridge is inspected by several consultants. There is usually one principal who hires a bunch of subs, and takes them a few months, probably 3 months.
Do you refer to the bridges by the names that we do, or is there a nomenclature for bridges?
Yes, there is. Every bridge has a 7-digit number. It's called Bridge Identification Number, or BIN. So every bridge has a BIN. But nevertheless, we're human, so we use the major names as well. Like the Brooklyn Bridge happens to be the Brooklyn Bridge.
Do you have a favorite bridge? And a least favorite bridge?
Occasional bridges alternate as the least favorite. I can't say I have a favorite, although the Brooklyn, like, stands out as the masterpiece of masterpieces, because it really is. Brooklyn, I mean, Roebling was a genius, no question about it. And just as, I mean, I love the Eiffel Tower, and the Brooklyn Bridge is in the same family. In fact, David Billington wrote this book, The Tower and the Bridge, and he also drew a parallel between the genius of the Eiffel Tower and the genius of the Brooklyn. So it deserves some special place. But I do like many bridges now, but the worst bridge depends on which bridge wakes me up at night the most. Recently there is this bridge over the Hutchinson River Parkway at Westchester Boulevard in the Bronx. And it gets hit by trucks, and these trucks just don't get it. There are a million signs, northbound and southbound, telling them how much the clearance is. And the impression I get is that as they read the sign, instead of stopping, they accelerate. So the bridge takes, the truck is usually demolished, but the police will not clear out of the location until a bridge engineer tells them that it's okay. And we have actually had to reinforce things to strengthen, etc. But we have to be there. If it's 1 o'clock in the morning, so be it. That's where we have to show up. And this bridge is a champion. Many bridges get hit, but this bridge gets hit the most. And you cannot raise it because there is subway going above the roadway. And you cannot lower the roadway because there are utility pipes under the roadway. All you can do is educate the drivers, and we have not been successful in that domain. Another that gets hit is the Brooklyn Bridge itself. The BQE going towards Queens under the Brooklyn Bridge, it gets hit a lot. It got hit a month ago very seriously. But that one will be remedied because that span that goes over the BQE will be replaced. And the new span will not be so, girder will not be so deep. So the clearance will slightly improve.
I have many more questions, but I should open it up to you guys. Questions for Jana?
You seem so involved with bridges. Do you, as a hobby, build model bridges like some people do model railroads? Do you have little matchsticks?
No, no. I never do that. At Columbia, there was a wonderful professor who is gone now, but he was my professor. Mario Salvadori was his name. He, Italian, Roman, he wrote many books, interesting books, and he taught classes at a school in Harlem, a high school, and he built with them very nice models which still survive. Mario is dead now more 20 years, but his models survive.
Where are they?
Probably in his Harlem high school. Where he taught. He taught all over. He taught architecture, he taught engineering, he taught me numerical methods. But his favorite was building models with the Harlem students in the high school.
Sina?
The Carroll Street Bridge.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about what kind of bridge that is?
Oh, yes.
It's so strange.
It's unique. The Carroll Street is a retractable bridge. Some will call it retractile. I don't know if that's true or not. But anyway, a retractable bridge is an old-fashioned bridge where you can really move that bridge with a pair of horses or something, because all it does is slides. What you need for such a bridge is extra land, because the bridge has to be at an angle to the channel, and there needs to be a lot of open area next to the bridge on one side of the channel, so that when you want to open the channel, you just pull on the bridge and it moves away from the channel. And that's what Carroll Street does. We have another such bridge on Borden Avenue in Queens, just physically under the LIE. There was such a bridge, but it no longer retracts. It's fixed because nobody goes over the Dutch Kill, through the Dutch Kills Canal. So the Borden Avenue... Well, the advantage is that you need very little force to move it. As I said, you can do it probably with a couple of horses, and they probably did. So Carroll Street, a lot of that structure is timber, and 25 years ago it was in bad shape, and New York City DOT workers looked at it in-house. Mostly we do things by contract. But they looked at it and they said, we can fix it. And they did. So that lasted until now, and now it needs another fix. This one will be contracted out, and to my knowledge, the bridge will remain a retractable bridge.
What kind of bridge would you like to see more of?
Personally, it's highly subjective. The day has come, concrete has invaded the bridge industry after steel was dominant for a century. And after concrete came pre-stressed, post-tensioned concrete, which means that you see these fancy concrete structures and you're wondering what the hell is keeping them up. And what is keeping them up is very high strength steel tendons at very high tension inside, about which you know nothing.
Me personally, or?
Nobody.
Okay.
Me neither.
Oh.
So there are all kinds of non-destructive, very fancy, almost on the nuclear level techniques to investigate what's happening with these tendons, because if they fail, the bridge falls. And so they're the latest, and they're very fancy, and... very elegant indeed, but not fun to inspect, and they're not fun to have. So my favorite bridges are the old riveted steel bridges built with Pittsburgh steel. And it breaks my heart that Bethlehem Steel is no longer there. And what are those bridges? You know, our bridges here, which were built during that time,
That time being
from the end of the 19th century all the way to the 50s. If they hadn't been built so well, they wouldn't be here now, because they took so much neglect in the 60s and the 70s, and they still survived, and they're still fixable. I mean, they're just wonderful.
How long have you been in New York?
Well, I came to study at Columbia in the early 70s, and I got my PhD in 76, I think, and then I spent a year in Europe, another 2 years at Berkeley, and then came back and have been here all the way through.
Yeah.
You just mentioned
in the States or
anywhere?
Well, I spent a lot of time in Europe, and I spent a lot of time in Japan. And in Europe, of course, they have several very interesting. Denmark is a great builder of bridges. The longest suspension bridge is now in Denmark, the Great Belt. And then there is the Öresund bridge, which goes between Denmark and Sweden. And that's an interest. And now there is the Viaduc de Millau in central France, which is a fantastic bridge. You got to see that bridge. But there are 7 towers taller than the Eiffel Tower. The bridge goes over a valley. It goes over a town. Yeah, so that's a sight.
You don't do tunnels, right?
No, I'm claustrophobic.
Is it a different department?
Well, actually, we have the city is responsible for 5 small tunnels. One of them is the Battery Underpass. The other is a small tunnel on First Avenue in front of the United Nations.
I hate that tunnel.
There you go. And so forth.
And the one under Park Avenue, like right before the...
Yeah. The one that was 2-way. Now at least we made it 1-way. Yeah, I've spent some nights there too. But to finish with answering, your question, I also have spent a lot of time in Japan. And the Japanese have learned a lot from our bridge problems. And they're still learning, so that's why they keep inviting me. I've been to Japan like 10 times, one time recently, and when I wrote the book, they translated it immediately, the Japanese. So they are operating in a way completely opposite to our way. The American way, a bridge has to prove its utility, and as the market moves, so does the maintenance of the bridge. Over there, they may kill themselves, but the bridge will be maintained. The longest bridge in the world is the Akashi Kaikyu Bridge, the main span of the bridge is 2 kilometers, which is about double what Verrazano is. All right? And it's a suspension bridge, and on a regular day, under the bridge, there is walkway just for service. And on the walkway, there are more maintenance people than there is traffic on top. And this is a $30 toll which needs to pay for the bridge. So why did they build the bridge? Well, because they want to have the longest bridge in the world. And I told them, I admire the bridge, but bridge building is not a competitive sport. You know, so I admire them, and at the same time I have some reservations, and eventually they will have reservations. So we have with Japan a very interesting relationship. We realize that we operate from different constraints.
Benita.
My question is kind of historical, but many people like to approach islands not by a bridge, but by a ferry.
Yes.
And that's the way it was always. If you wanted to go there, mm-hmm. to the ferry. So why not?
Why not?
How different Manhattan would be if we all approached it?
In the case of New York City, everybody seems to agree that the Brooklyn Bridge created the city, and it would not have been it without. So this is what we call a fixed crossing. And they built the Brooklyn Bridge, then they built the Williamsburg Bridge, then they built simultaneously the Queensboro and the Manhattan bridges, and it became a city. In fact, I've seen a cartoon with 100 bridges going. And the question, where is it going to end? And then the GW Bridge was a very important crossing also, which had to be negotiated, and where shall we put it, etc. And it's the most, the GW is the most traveled bridge in the world. The GW brings in tolls. The GW pays for itself every 5 years in tolls. Let me put it this way. Never mind how much it brings. Daily it brings now about $2 million. All right? So it looks like they need it, the users. But in other instances, like for instance, the Messina Straits, do they need the world's longest bridge, 3 kilometer main span that will be if they build it? And there is a design for it. So I told you, Akashi, 2 kilometers. This will be 3 kilometers if they build it. So do they need it? And that's a big question. Yes. The same thing with the Great Belt.
Yeah.
There's a very interesting bridge here, slightly dial between the Bronx and the
Bronx. Yes.
It spins, or it looks like it spins. It's in the river and it's always sort of tilted.
Yeah, it doesn't spin, it stays that
way. Okay, it's not an operation.
Well, that was intended, that's a railroad bridge. That's a railroad bridge, I don't know how much. The arch which carries the Henry Hudson Bridge over there, that's an interesting bridge, the Henry Hudson Highway. That bridge is not a city bridge. It was designed by Steinman in 1908. He was a student at Columbia. He was an applicant for a doctorate, and he wrote a book, handwritten, with hand drawings for this bridge. I have the book because the library threw it out. So he designed it in 19, and they refused to give him a doctorate because his proposal was too practical, and doctorates were supposed to be theoretical. That's a little embarrassing. I have a doctorate from Columbia, Steinman does. But anyway, Steinman didn't give up. They gave him some other degree, but not a PhD. Anyway, 20 years later, he built the bridge. He built according to his student design.
Wow.
And that Stipend Dyville is just below it, that tilted thing. But it was for rail only.
And they don't use it anymore?
Rail still crosses, so yes, they do.
So it's fit.
Yeah, this is called the swing bridge.
And who operates?
Well, the swing bridge? The swing bridge is rotated, again, by operator, but it has to be in the middle. We have swing bridges on the Harlem River. We have the Willis Avenue, the 3rd Avenue, 145th Street. These are swing bridges. We just put them there, brand new. And they're swinging also. Now, the Broadway Bridge, which is next to that one, the one that carries Broadway, is a lift bridge. It used to be a swing bridge. The swing bridge was taken out of there and floated over to University Heights, and it's still swinging at University Heights.
Just one last question. Do you think we're ever going to see a new major bridge?
In this area?
Yeah, I mean,
historically, always acquiring the land has been the most difficult thing. You get the land, you'll find people who will build the bridge. Right now, they're building new bridges. We actually spoke about that. The Tappan Zee will be 2 new cable stayed bridges, 2. And the existing one, I don't know if they will or will not convert it to some kind of a park, promenade, something like that. Maybe they'll get rid of it, maybe they'll maintain it. But next to it, there will be 2 major. And new bridges will be built by the state. The Kosciuszko over Newton Creek, that bridge is kind of on its last legs. Well, it carries traffic, but it needs to go. It has needed to go for a while. And it will be, again, 2 cable stayed bridges. Cable stayed are the bridges where you have these diagonals going, mm-hmm. not the suspension bridge. The Brooklyn Bridge is a unique hybrid.
Because it's both.
It's both, yes. Yeah.
All right, well, I'm sure there will be many more questions, but we should probably move on. Thank you very much for... What did you know, Yanov? So our next guest, who's not exactly, because we're his guests, so our next host will be Sina Najafi, giving a slide talk as a minor obsessive about umbrellas.
All right. Just a quick survey. Does anybody here who hates umbrellas in a Oh, wow. Wow, really? Really? I have 28. You can have one of them.
Eight?
Can you speak up a bit, though, Sina?
Yes, I can.
Do you want to take the lavalier? Or?
I could take the lavalier, sure. Ah, and this is not connected.
This is a very delicate maneuver. Men die doing this.
No signal. Maybe that was the problem. That worked? Great. I've done talks on cats, hedgehogs, and Rafael Nadal, three things I love very much. This is by far the most embarrassing one because I realized that my love of umbrellas comes from one particular moment in my life, and I'm afraid I'll have to share it with you. I'll share it a little bit backwards. In 1982, I got on a plane in London and landed here to go to college. And if you'd asked me at the time why I came here, I would have said something like, the education here is what I'm looking for, et cetera, et cetera. But over the years, I slowly realized that there were three American objects that I was especially cathected toward, and I had invested a lot too much time thinking about them in various ways. They were the fragments of my version of the American dream. They were these three objects: the kitchen island, the station wagon, and the bunk bed. I've done very well as an immigrant here. I now own a kitchen island. I have a station wagon, and I'm in the process of trying to convince my wife that we should get a bunk bed. But so those happened to be the American dream for me. But in 1975, my family and I got on a plane from Tehran, and we went to England, and we emigrated there to England. And the love of umbrellas comes right before this trip because my dad, as he was putting my mother and me on the plane, he wasn't going to come with us at that moment, said something like, you're going to a very civilized society, and you can tell because of the way the English people use their umbrellas. And I must have asked him another question because he then went on to explain that English people use their umbrellas maximally. They swing them while they're walking. They do all kinds of stuff with them, but they never hit anybody with them. And when the rain comes and all the umbrellas are out, they manage to coexist in this beautiful way. And for him, this was the sign of a higher civilization. And for me, as a 9-year-old, this also became a sign of a higher civilization. So when I came to England, this was the object toward which I cathected in many, many ways. I think in his own funny way, my dad was trying to say something like, classic liberalism is still alive in England, where the public-private divide works in a very smooth, functional way, where you understand where your private realm is, and then you also are careful not to go into the public realm in some aggressive way. And perhaps he was right, perhaps he wasn't, but this was the illusion under which I emigrated to England. Hence the love of umbrellas, probably. And I still enjoy an amazing scene in London when lots of people with umbrellas are walking down the street together, and the choreography of it is still very interesting to me. First, I should say what is not of interest, because umbrellas have many relatives, and I'm going to ask Eben about one of them, which I decided not to include. I'm not interested in parasols. They're very, very different. And this is a scene from Persepolis, the seat of the Persian Empire, showing a king with a parasol being carried behind him. There are many scenes like this. This is from the Assyrian, this is from Nineveh, the seat of the Assyrian Empire, and you see the same kind of thing. The parasol does not have the amazing separation that you have between your realm, where you're very, very different, dry, and just there where you're wet. So in a parasol, what you have is a fine shielding of the sun, but you don't have that abrupt move that I think is key to understanding how an umbrella works in the world. So in that sense, parasols have nothing to do with this. They're much older than umbrellas. They're the forefathers of umbrellas. They have an amazing lineage, but we're not interested in them. We're also not interested in gimmicks. So, for example, we're not interested in, this is a very early, you think these are all Japanese inventions from the 80s and 90s, but this is Robert Patton in Seattle in 1900 with something that made him very famous. another similar invention. This is a good one, but we're not interested in
it. I know where you're going. I know where you're going with this.
The touch of genius here is that there's a little spigot at the bottom, so that as the water accumulates in the pipe, then you can open the spigot and the water can come out. So this is how to smoke in the English rain. This is a new device called the Newbrella. I don't know if anyone's had the misery of seeing this thing in public. I have. But what this does is it encloses the self completely. So the entire relationship between in and outs, private and public, is broken down because you're in a bubble, leaving your hands free to talk on your cell phone. So it just completely shields you from the public sphere that you're supposed to be in. So in that sense, I'm very much against these newfangled devices. What's that? It is a sphere. It's a private sphere gone nuts. So, and I'm also intrigued by this umbrella because it's just an oversized umbrella. But what it is that you can't have everybody have this umbrella. So in that sense, it allows one person to do this, but not everybody. Has anybody seen this umbrella before? It's made by an artist called Alexandra Mirren. She takes it all around the world, and this is her walking with it. But so these are things that we're not interested in. The first thing, I should just give you a little small history of the umbrella, which is interesting. For a long time, the parasol ruled, and it's only in the early 17th century that techniques for making that covering waterproof became available enough that we had something that was not just against sun, you know, just something that gave you shade, but something that was against rain. And in fact, the French word parapluie, you know, which is against the rain, that is the first word that describes this function, and that's the word that's used in England for a while, etc. And it's the French that invent this, in fact, this idea of a rain-specific item. In 1709, a guy by the name of Jean Marius, he invents the first collapsible umbrella. And this is a huge hit amongst fashionable people. Very expensive. I have the prices for one of these things from his shop in the Faubourg Saint-Honoré. It would have cost you about 15 and 22 livres, which would be the equivalent of $750 to $1,100 to buy a collapsible umbrella that was rainproof at the time. A non-collapsing umbrella from him would have cost you only 9 livres. So this collapsible function, which everybody wanted, was extremely expensive. Louis XIV loves this invention, as do a whole bunch of other well-known people. And Louis, in fact, gives him a proto-patent on it. No one else is allowed to make an umbrella for 5 years. So Jean Marius has a monopoly for 5 years. From there, it comes to England. But again, it's only women who are using it. Men are ridiculed if they use it. And that is, in fact, the case for a couple of decades until this gentleman comes along, Jonas Hanway. And he walks around from 1750 until his death in the 1780s with an umbrella. And to begin with, he would get... Here's a contemporary diary of the time. It describes the kinds of things that people would shout to him, including, "Frenchman, Frenchman, why don't you call a coach?" Because that's what you're supposed to do if you're a man. Get in a coach and go to your destination, not walk under an umbrella. But he went through the ridicule, and in fact, the popularity of umbrella rose in the 1770s. Thanks to him. In fact, there's a statue of him as the man who popularized the umbrella in England. This is in Nottingham, but there are statues of him all over England. Here's another image of him being less ridiculed.
All Frenchman, why don't you call it?
It's okay to carry a basket on your head, but...
So the choreography of public space, which is beautiful... I couldn't get a film of England, say, like the 50s, 60s, a classic day of the umbrella, heyday of the umbrella in England. But this is from the opening scene of Umbrellas of Cherbourg. I don't know if people have seen this. It's a beautiful scene. Ah. Hold on. No? No sound. I have it up here. Great. So this small town, I actually moved to Canterbury, it was a small town, and very similar to this in density of people, and the same kinds of choreographies of little bourgeois monads walking, you know, in concert with each other in this wonderful way. But then in 1978, something happened in London, which probably most of you don't remember, which is something that happened to this guy. Do you remember this? Murkoff? Yeah. So this is a Bulgarian dissident who had had a lot of trouble in back home and had been given asylum in England. And in 1978, crossing Westminster Bridge, I think it was Westminster Bridge, he was waiting for a bus there and felt this thing in the back of his leg, turned around, and saw somebody who dropped his umbrella, who said sorry, and walked away. A few days later, he was dead. And it turned out that this umbrella, probably yielded by a KGB agent, had this incredible device in it. It sort of looked like this. And it administered a little dose of ricin into his leg. And he died a few days later. But he did remember what had happened enough to tell people that this is what happened. And the umbrella suddenly took on a whole other... This is the first, you know... spy moment with an umbrella that was true outside of James Bond. And the umbrella became this other thing in England as a result of that. Here's a sort of a diagram of what it would have looked like. And I don't, maybe people here know better than me, I don't think the person was ever caught, right? I think...
No, not
no never caught.
No.
Yeah. But they think it's the KGB, but that was...
A KGB colonel, because I'm Bulgarian. So.
Oh, okay.
Assistance to kill this guy.
I see.
And Andropov, who was the boss of KGB, opposed it. So he said, we won't do it, but we'll teach you how. But the Bulgarians practiced, according to the book, practiced on jail inmates, and they couldn't do it. The inmates used bad language and complained but did not die. So they hired a professional. The kid has not been called just to this.
Do you know this because it happened on a bridge?
No, I know it because I'm Bulgarian. And the killed man, Mr. Marko, was a popular writer.
Yeah.
And he's, from what I understand, I mean, he's one generation slightly before me, but from what I understand, his greatest sin was that he was too close to the leader, and then he defected the leader.
Yeah.
In fact, there was rumor about the umbrella used again on another Bulgarian in Paris.
A Bulgarian in Paris?
Yeah. But that was never really quite true.
There we go. That's better. But there turned out to be a very long history of weapons being used as umbrellas, even before the gadgets became so complicated. This is an index from a book by Lieutenant Colonel Baron de Beranger in 1835, and he describes the umbrella as a weapon in a number of places in his book. And this is just the index, so you get a sense of, you know, umbrella may be used as a weapon, save from the attack of a mad dog who attacked him by using his umbrella. So the umbrella starts to gather some pedigree here as a device that could save you. I'm not going to go through that. But it really comes to a head with Bartissu. And Bartissu is an invention of an English guy by the name of Edward Barton Wright. And it's jiu-jitsu and the first syllable of his name, Barton, put together. So Bartissu. And he's an engineer who spent a number of years in Japan, and he wanted to put together a mixed martial art that combined all of the ones he was familiar with in a way that would be useful for urban defense, so for the unsafe streets of London, for people just walking around with a walking stick and, say, an umbrella. And so a lot of the exercises that you could learn when you went to his gymnasium to learn this martial art that Sherlock Holmes, for example, by the way, also mentions at one point, involves sticks and umbrellas. And here are some more of, or using your cloak to throw it on the person with a dagger. So it's sort of the gentleman's way of disarming the person who approaches you in a city. And there is, in fact, I'm going to do this. Let's see if I can do this. There is a reconstruction of some of the lessons that I found, because Bartissu apparently is becoming very popular again. I don't know why.
Combination of both. Jonathan, you asked me to come and show you some Bartissu, which I'm always happy to do, and I've actually brought my student, Alex, to come and help us out.
Sir.
Pleasure to meet you. You're going to be beating up on him all day. Now, first thing we're going to start with is the plain old simple umbrella. So we'll give you a simple technique to start with. Alex, if you can come at me with two hands like you're going to choke me.
Yep.
Stop. As he's coming in, what I want to do is look for the outside of his wrist or his elbow, and using the umbrella, the soft part of the umbrella, turn him to the side while I pivot out of the way. That's step one. Step two, break his nose or his teeth.
Favorite step so far.
Step three, you're gonna like this one. Hook around the back of the neck, catch in front of the throat, pull him into you. Right?
Yeah.
In the words of the Victorian literature, you may now belabor him with your weapon.
All right, I'm ready for a fancy fight.
As long as you take it one step at a time. All right, step one. Pivot, turn, sweep. Step two, jab. Break his teeth and nose. Step three, hook. Catch, pull him in toward you.
He's heavy, though.
Not if you throw him down.
Oh, yeah.
Step four, finish.
Okay. So much for that. And then for a finale, let's go back to this. Of course, James Bond has an umbrella like this, but this is the current version of what Sarkozy had commissioned, and I don't remember if people know this $20,000 umbrella that Sarkozy
Liée à la politique, une commande insolite pour assurer à l'avenir la sécurité du président de la République. La commande d'une dizaine de parapluies blindés. Ils se déplient en un dixième de seconde et c'est un petit bijou de technologie. Des parapluies fabriqués, bien sûr, à Cherbourg. Reportage Axel Girard et Sylvain Rollin.
Cela ne saute pas aux yeux, mais ce parapluie n'arrête pas que les gouttes. Le Parapactum, c'est son nom, peut stopper un pavé, bloquer un manifestant. C'est une PME cherbourgeoise qui a développé ce petit bijou de technologie.
Il y a eu des tests en soufflerie à l'Institut aérotechnique de Saint-Cyr. Et le résultat, le Parapactum, 168 km/h face au vent.
Son secret, un alliage de Kevlar, de titane et d'aluminium, sur lequel l'inventeur en dit le moins possible. En attendant de conquérir une clientèle de stars ou d'hommes politiques à travers le monde, ce parapluie a déjà un client. La présidence de la République a acheté 10 exemplaires après un test avec les chiens du raid.
Le chien est arrivé à je ne sais combien, mais je pense que c'est à peu près 35 km/h, un chien qui court. Et il s'est jeté sur le garde du corps du raid et qui avait le parapluie et qui l'a non seulement arrêté, mais repoussé sur le côté.
Décidément, les parapluies de Cherbourg ont bien changé. Cette petite merveille de technologie a demandé 2 ans de recherche. Elle a un coût entre 5 et 10 000 euros pièce.
Et on imagine Axel Girard avec une petite jupette et des couettes.
There's a report that it can also stop a petanque ball that's thrown at the president, in case that ever happens. So we'll stop there. Thank you.
Before you go, what do you recommend?
What kind of umbrella?
What's your favorite kind of umbrella? What do you recommend?
You should buy a Sens umbrella. Have you seen those? They're asymmetrical. They're amazing in the wind. Yeah. The more the wind blows, the more upright it becomes. S-E-N-Z.
There you go. You heard it here.
$40-$50, something like that.
Generally, no questions, except I get to exercise that prerogative, but you can ask them later. All right.
Excellent. Back to you. This one. Thank you.
What is in them?
Yes. Well, because this year is the theoretical 105th anniversary of the daiquiri, I'm interested in daiquiri variations this summer. And so this is we've got a classic daiquiri, rum, sugar, and fresh lime juice. But we infused it today with a little bit of Calabrese hot peppers. And then we muddled in oregano. I was thinking about a pizza and a daiquiri in combination, I suppose. So that is the ingredient list, and I hope you like them. I have some more if you guys want. At the end of the show, if you've not been here before, we ask you to supply a name for this said cocktail. Well, they need to think about it a little bit. So white rum, lime juice, sugar, hot peppers, and oregano.
We're losing, as the talk show ends for the season, we're slowly falling apart. My lavalier is now broken. I'm sure other limbs will fall off and other things will happen. But before they do, okay, here's my microphone. I want to introduce our next guest. He is a professional caddy at a club that shall probably remain nameless. Please welcome Alex Jacobson. I'm sorry, I'm speaking into a tiny microphone.
That's all right.
I'm sorry we took so long to get you up, and I know you have to leave very early because...
I do.
Why?
I'm caddying tomorrow morning at 8:15 in Boston, outside of Boston. So, yeah, I'm going to be driving back home right now. Or, I mean, in like 20 minutes, 25 minutes.
That must be fairly
half an hour.
That must be fairly lucrative to make that worth your time.
It is. Well, it's a tournament.
Love helping others.
It's a tournament.
It's a tournament.
Yes.
Okay.
There are three major 3-round, 3-to-5-round tournaments during the course of the summer. So there's a member who will take his, you know, best buddy or someone who he owes a really big favor to for, you know, this 3-to-5-round tournament. And then at the end, if they win, they win a bunch of, you know, the kitty at the end of it, or most likely not, they just pay the caddy a lot of money and pay the club a lot of money to play.
So the caddies wind up being competitive with each other as much as the players do.
Not really. I mean, the caddies aren't. They have no say in who you get, so it's not really a competition in that way. You're at the mercy of you know, your boss.
And so, have you been? Do you only caddy at this club?
Yes, I've caddied at other clubs, and occasionally I'll go to another club to caddy, but almost always just one club.
Why don't they just use a cart?
Because it's a really old-fashioned club that it's, I don't know how many of you are golfers, but it's a lot more fun to play if you're walking than if you're riding. The riding, it breaks up the rhythm, the momentum of the round, because you're, you know, driving 20 miles an hour and then you stop and then you have to wait for 10 minutes or 15 minutes, and you know, it breaks up the rhythm. And it's just, you know, it's about walking, and it's also a lot better on the course because you don't have cart tracks around.
And
it's also
just much more fun if you've got just to watch somebody else carrying your shit.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, if you know, if you're a member, you know, they're used to it too. So,
how long have you been a caddy?
12 years, maybe something like that.
At this course.
At this course, 6 years. I switched courses about 6 years ago to a different course.
Do you golf?
Yes, I do. I started quite young, and I played high school competitive golf and college golf. I played for a while.
I don't know what a handicap is, but what's your handicap?
About 3, give or take. Yeah.
Okay, what's a handicap?
It's the simplest way to explain it is the average amount over par you are for an 18-hole round.
The average amount over par?
Yeah. Okay. And there are, it goes from about, you know, a pro would be like +6, which means negative, you know, 6 under on average around, to like, just regular 3.
Regular.
It's backwards, so a +3 means -3. So I'm just 3. Just it's really complicated. It can be confusing, but
okay, so we should back up a second. How many
yes.
of you guys are golfers?
Yeah.
2 of you.
Nice.
How many people have a clear idea? I can tell by your shorts. How many people have a clear idea what a caddy does?
That's pretty good.
Wow. Okay.
For non golfers. More or less, yeah.
But if you're good enough to be a pro, or if you're good enough to follow all these observances, why do you need someone else to advise you on your club?
Because you're not a pro. I caddy at a club. There are two different types of caddies. There are club caddies and there are pro caddies. And a pro caddy will carry for one person, and as they go around the country doing, you know, on the tour. And so you're stuck with them, and you can change, you know, your guy, but you're, you know, most of them have contracts for a particular golfer. I show up at the same course every day at 6:15, and I get whoever I get, and I go home at the end of the day. It's a lot nicer because I'm not in, like, you know, Topeka, Kansas 1 week, and, you know, wherever, Montana the next week, and I can have a real life too, right, which is nice.
Do they
so nobody at the club says, "I want that Jacobson kid." I'm always good with him.
No, well, not really. There are so many caddies that it to have like a personal. They only play maybe 2 times a week or so. So it, you know, you wouldn't make that much money.
Do they ever? But it seems like it's. I'm having a hard time articulating what I find so odd about the job. Maybe because it's more than one job. So you're kind of. You're like the golf butler.
A companion. A golf companion.
You're a golf companion.
Yes. That's okay. That's how I think about it.
So does it? But I mean, in the same way, a mixologist or a bartender might be like an alcohol companion.
Exactly.
Do you wind up receiving confidences? Are people like, I have a terrible stroke. Also, my wife is leaving me.
To some extent, but, you know, most of the time it's a big group of people. You know, it's so there's four golfers in a normal round plus two caddies. So it's, you know, they're mostly and a lot of the golf is guest, you know, taking guests out. So it's they want to either, you know, it's either business golf or it's friends that they want to catch up with. So there's not a whole lot of, you know, personal time.
Okay. What's well, in that case, what is the rudest thing a patron has ever said to you?
I'm not sure about to me myself, but there was this, you know, member and so one of the older caddies, who's been there for 40, 50 years, working at the same club, you know, goes out with him and you know, let's call him the member, you know, Phil. And so he says, you know, Phil, you know, can I just call you Phil? Is that all right? And he says, I'd prefer you didn't. Call me Mr., you know, whoever. And that's about as low as it gets.
If that's as low as it goes, that's doing pretty well.
I mean, we're, you know, we see these people every day, or, you know, frequently enough. So if you, you know, if you're a dick, then it gets around and...
So do you guys, I mean, do you gossip about patrons?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, yeah.
I mean, just bear in mind that my only understanding of golf is from movies and Archie comics.
Okay.
So I have a very, possibly, but what I'm imagining is people really tanking in really embarrassing ways, you know. And then do you guys...
Golf-wise or otherwise?
Golf-wise.
Yeah.
Well, do you tell me? But like golf-wise.
Almost
but then,
always.
What?
Almost always.
Almost always. But
yes.
But then are you caddies like... Like, I mean, do you have a secret kind of hand signal of like, check out the?
Yeah, I mean, it's more, you know, looking at each other and saying, you know, shaking your head and like, am I really, you know, watching this? I mean, they're all really bad, in the grand scheme of things, because they have like, a lot of them have professions and they're doing that, you know, 50 hours a week, and they come out on the weekend, so they're, you know, they should be bad. They don't practice ever.
But do they get self-conscious playing in front of people who are implicitly really good or who know the course really well?
No, I don't think so. They haven't, you know. I think that the guests got a lot more embarrassed of playing poorly with the member because, you know, they don't want to be uninvited again, you know, or future rounds.
But they don't get embarrassed in front of the caddies, even though it's understood the caddies are probably across the board better golfers than
they
are.
Not necessarily. I think I'm one of the better player caddies at the club.
Okay.
In the maybe top five of the caddies that play there.
And you get to use the course for free, I take it.
Once, twice a week, yeah. We get to play the main course on Mondays, and then there's a nine-hole course in addition to that, which is just sort of the mini course that we can play Thursdays and sort of afternoons if it's slow.
If you've been caddying the same course for 6 years, do you get bored of the course?
No, it's one of the top courses in the country. I think it's fantastic. I mean, I love playing it. It's totally repetitious, and you get bored a lot more of, you know, the what you're doing than the course. I think, you know, the course is a really good course.
And how often do they ask you for advice?
It really depends on the player. There are players who never speak to me, I mean, about anything golf related in the entire round. And there are people I, you know, basically instruct them in every single shot where to hit it or what club to hit or, you know, or strategy or
which do you
like
prefer?
I think everybody prefers the former.
Being left alone.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Because you don't have to do anything. You just carry the bags and, you know, watch some golf and it's all right. And there's a lot more to think about and sort of, because often the latter are people who aren't playing very well and, you know, it's a lot more work because there are a lot more shots. So if there are 100 shots, that means you're dropping the bag and instructing 100 different times, as opposed to someone who's shooting, you know, 75, who doesn't ask you for advice. So it's 25 less times you have to drop the bag right next to their ball.
Was it hard developing your musculature for this? Were you?
I mean, I started playing when I was 5, so it you sort of get used to it.
So you had a 2-year-old caddy?
Yeah, I played with a caddy maybe 3 or 4 times in tournaments. I'll get a friend to caddy for me, but that's about it.
Because I guess I'm wondering how the position evolved. I mean, is it because you no longer have a good stroke if you've been carrying around a really heavy golf bag? Or?
It evolved because golf has for the last, you know, 450, 500 years been an exclusively, you know, wealthy endeavor. And so you have people to carry whatever, you know, things you're carrying wherever you're going, so you might as well have someone to carry.
Right, but this
your golf
is course. I guess the part that I find really unique and interesting about this is, like, if I hire a bunch of people to move my piano.
Right.
If I'm if I'm wealthy enough to hire a bunch of people to move to have a piano, but then I'm generally once they haul that thing up in the apartment, I'm not going to be like, now where do you think it should go? Which is what seems like odd about the caddies. On the one hand, they're operating as a servant, but then on the other hand, they're operating as an advisor.
Yes, and that's what I think is really interesting is that you are at the same time subservient and sort of. Superservient, is that a word?
I don't know.
Okay. You know more than they do, but also you're at a lower level. So it's
how do they tolerate that?
Oh, I mean, they're not going to carry their own club, so.
Are you expected to be complimentary of good play?
Yes. I mean, you're not gonna you know, watch some guy, you know, hit into the water and say, well, that sucked. You know, that's not going to help your, you know, bottom line, so to speak.
Right. But if he greens it on 2 and you're supposed to say great shot, or is it?
Yeah, I mean, yes and no, because that gets tricky. Once you get a better player, they don't want to hear that because, you know.
That's what I was asking.
Yeah. At a certain level, and that's where it gets really tricky. You have to really feel out each person independently, because some people don't want to hear anything. You know, they may, what you think is a good shot, they may have hit it poorly or gotten lucky or something like that. But generally, yes, that's more so when you get to the pro level, because they actually know a whole lot more about what they're doing.
But you do say great shot.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it, you know, it builds confidence, and that's part
and
of
tips.
It's like, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I had another question that just totally escaped me.
That's right.
No, it's my fault.
Yeah.
I interrupted you.
So is the professional caddy is actually more of a sports psychologist or a coach?
I would, yeah, definitely. I mean, there are some of the caddies on the pro tour are swing coaches as well, but very few of them. Mostly it's sports psychologists. Because the player know and arithmetic, you know, mathematics, just doing the numbers to figure out how far away they are, because the player will know exactly to the yard or sometimes to the half yard what club they're going to hit.
Actually, I do remember the question. Yeah. And I'm going to turn it over to you guys. I remember the one time I went golfing was with my dad, who had formerly had a good stroke.
Mm-hmm.
The last time he had played golf, which was maybe like 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. But it seems like, I mean, you see this in movies all the time, but like, it seems that golf, maybe because it's a weird mix of solitary and competitive, is just, people are more prone to tantrums. Then what's the worst tantrum you've ever seen on a golf course?
Let's see. Again, the worst tantrum I've heard about. I don't really see that many tantrums. This is people know better than to have tantrums, because it gets back to the club elite, you know, the president of the club or something like that, and they could get kicked off the course. At the previous club I worked at, this guy got really upset, so he was in the bunker. And he threw the club against the sort of face of the bunker, and it ricocheted and hit this kid in the leg. And then he did it again, like 3 holes later. And so the kid comes back and you know, at the end of the round and says, you know, maybe they pulled him off the course midway through and his leg is bleeding. And so they, like, you know, put some water on it gave him a Band-Aid. And he goes home, you know, at the end of the day, and he, you know, he tells his dad, you know, I just got hit in the leg by this guy twice. And the guy said, well, that's a bad day of work, huh? Which I just thought was great.
And on that note, questions for Alex? You, sir.
What do you do in the winter?
That's a good question. I went to art school. It's everybody has a winter sort of thing that they do, or sometimes they don't and they just, you know, bum around. When I was in college, I would do it for the summer and then go back to college. For the last 5 years I've been out of college, I have done this in the summer and then found internships at museums, galleries in Boston. And then last winter, I started a picture frame business. So I've been doing that for the last... And so that is weaning me out of caddying full-time. And full-time is, for me, 2 years ago, is 200 rounds in 6 months. And last year it was about 100 rounds, so that's sort of halftime. And this year it's going to be probably more like 75.
Are you going to miss it?
No.
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 But it sounds like you really like it.
I mean, I can still go when I want to, which is the great thing about it, is that it's totally flexible. You don't have a boss. You don't have to, you know, call in to say you're going to be sick, or, you know, you just show up when you want to. Because there are so many tournaments, I can show up for the tournaments, know I'm going to get out at, you know, 12:30 tomorrow. You know, I know I show up there in 45 minutes, I'm getting out at 9. If you show up on a regular day, you show up at 6:15 and you wait till whenever you go out. And that may be 10 o'clock, it may be 1:30. So if you got there at 6:15 and you're waiting till 1:30 and then you work till, you know, till 5:30, That's a long day of work for the same amount as if you just, you know.
But is it like non-union labor waiting for a truck in the morning, like to see how many caddies they need? Do people sort of like haze people with less seniority?
You show up at 6:15, and you wait until you get out, and that isn't necessarily when you came. It's sort of seniority. It's sort of when you came. It's sort of who the member is, and they try to pair members and caddies that would work well together.
But if you show up at a new course. Like
it's
unannounced.
Difficult. Yeah, it's. Yeah, I mean, you may get out at the end of the day after all the regular guys have gone,
right?
And that's why you stick to one course, is because they know you. They know you're going to show up every day. They know if they say, you know, we've got someone who wants you tomorrow morning at 10:30, you're going to be there.
And who brokers it?
The caddy master.
The caddy master.
Yes.
Employed by the club.
Yes, he's also a starter, so he. He organizes who goes out at what times, but also has a radio down to the shack to match people.
Do you have to tip him out?
No, but again, that's a good question, because in previous administrations of the club, that was, you know, in the last, you know, previously, that was something that happened on a regular basis. In the new administration of the club, got rid of that guy. And stop that practice, but it possibly still goes on, but not to the extent. I mean, it was like to the point where you knew that you were giving $5 or $10 out of every tip, you know, out of every round to the caddy master.
It seems so green and pure, and it's
yeah,
so corrupt.
I know. Well, there's a rate that includes tip, ostensibly. So a lot of the members will just pay the rate and be perfectly happy, and you're perfectly happy because it's enough. A lot of the times, if you have a guest group, the guest will give you a slider, because it's sort of like around the member who's paying the full boat, and then they'll give you, you know, $20 or $50. Occasionally, you know, you'll get $100 from the guest. But it gets tricky, because if you know that they may think that they're paying for their own bag. You have to tell the member, because if you get double paid, you can get into some serious sort of serious issues. Or you can get, you know, thrown off the club for a week or something like that. You don't graduate from club caddy to pro caddy often. It's almost always at this point some buddy of theirs that they knew when they were growing up, or someone that was recommended to them by their agent or something like that. Someone who knows golf at a very high level, that is able to do it, and that wants to do it, because a lot of people don't want to be a pro caddy. It's a terrible life. You can make a lot less as a pro caddy unless you have maybe the top 100 guys on the PGA Tour. And then it flips, and, you know, it gets astronomical. I mean, the you know, like Tiger Woods caddy probably makes well over $1 million a year. You get the standard rate for tour tournaments is 5% if you're outside the top 10, 7% if you're, like, in the top 10, and 10% of the winnings if you win. So if Tiger Woods wins $1.5 million for a tournament, the caddy's probably getting $150,000 for a week, wow, which is pretty good. Yeah.
Straddling, like, the golf world and the art school world.
Yeah.
I was never a good golfer, but mm-hmm. I really appreciate golf.
Yeah.
I've spent a lot of time in, like, art world, vicinity, whatever.
Yeah.
How do you feel about just, like, golf culture? Because I think the sport is so beautiful.
Yeah.
And I really love the competition, and I love everything it takes to get good. But I remember, like, being with my friends who were really good.
Yeah.
It's just, like, so annoying.
Yeah. I mean, there's different types of golf culture.
Yeah.
I mean, the culture that I'm in is totally different than, you know, when I grew up playing golf with my high school.
Right.
Which, yeah, there was a lot of annoying sort of preppiness. And then I went to Bates College, which was a whole bunch more preppiness.
Right.
I don't know. I see them very differently. I don't really. There are members that I've talked with a lot about. You know, there are collectors, obviously, that are that wealthy that they're, you know, frequenting the galleries in town and galleries in New York. So I can talk to them about that, but it's, you know, I try to separate the two as much as I can, really.
So you never caddy for artists?
Let's see. I've caddied for photographers who are doing well enough. Some of the members at the course, you know, they are doing well enough where they don't have to work, and they can then just go do whatever they want. So sometimes they get into art that way.
Yeah, I didn't mean to falsely emphasize the divide as, like, clear cut, but it's just something.
Yeah, it's I don't know. I'm okay with it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Two more. Eve.
Yeah. Sorry. It's got to be. I see some really bright, bright colors on the course that really shouldn't be on a golf. Like bright pink shorts, you know. Any on a golf course, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I meant on a guy. For women's attire, there are rules about how short your skirt can be at the club, and I think the rule is 4 inches above your knee. And so there's this woman who's very tall and skinny, and goes to the club and buys a skirt. She had just become a member, and someone, like, she finishes the round and she gets a letter, and that's how you know you make a mistake at the club. You get a letter. And she gets a letter that says, actually, your skirt was well, you know, above the and she said, I got it here. Like, what am I supposed to do? Like, have some skirts that are appropriate length for me.
How is this matter resolved?
I'm not sure. I think she was, you know, maybe she gave back the offending skirt.
One more? Yeah.
Growing up with the sport and loving the sport and, you know, working so long in it.
I guess I see so many other things that are more contaminating than running a golf course that's sort of the way. The golf course has been there for 120 years. So, you know, I hope that they do as much as I can. They have ponds that they get the water from to water the course. So it's not like it's, you know, coming from well water or something like that. I believe, I'm not entirely sure, but you know, there are holding ponds in the course that feed the irrigation system. And I kind of think that they wouldn't put anything that terrible that is going to make anybody sick because, you know, occasionally you'll have fertilizer and some people will be, you know, irritated by the fertilizer or something like that. But I think there are just so many more things that are you know, that you could be worried about than more water being watered on the golf course than should be.
Is the caddy shack anything like Caddy Shack?
In what way? I mean, like the Caddy Shack, our Caddy Shack is it's more of a lean-to than a shack. It's three-walled, which originally we had the tent from the U.S. Open when I was there, and the Red Cross tent, or the sort of like the first aid tent, which was all plastic sided, like really thick plastic walls and roof. And then they thought that looked ugly and gross, and which it did, because it was 30 years old. It was 20 years old. And so they built this structure. And originally, they had told us that there were going to be like plastic siding on the front because it gets really cold if you're waiting there and there's frost on the ground and it's like 30 degrees out and you're waiting for 6 hours, it gets a little cold. So right now we have a three-sided shack that originally was not built with electricity, but they put in a light and an electric.
Okay. This is a really well-respected golf club. This is a place where you can make a lot of money.
I think I know which club this is.
Do you?
Okay.
But
it's the Country Club of Brookline, isn't it? Yeah.
He's not going to confirm or deny. But so, I guess, do you ever just get? I mean, clearly you're very suave at this job, and clearly, the stuff about it you love. But do you ever just get kind of pissed off or grossed out or? You've just been, like, I mean, really? Like, a light bulb and no walls?
I mean, if you're there every day and this is your full-time gig, absolutely. The way I have it right now, I'm only there as much as I need to be, really. And so it's not as bad. But if you're there every day, I mean, just the waiting around is the killer. The way I think about it is, once you get onto the golf course, that's the easy part. Like, that's enjoyable, that's nice, and you're getting paid pretty well to do it. But the waiting around, like, waiting 6 hours when it's 40 degrees out, that kind of sucks.
Okay, very last question. Yes. Is it a job that you really like because you're very good at it and you can make money, or is there stuff, like Armen Yanov clearly loves bridges, Is there something you find poetry in caddying, or is it just something you're very good at that you can do?
I think I do really enjoy it. And we have people who, you know, who are there, maybe will do 15 rounds a year or 30 rounds a year and don't need to, but they enjoy it. I mean, it's good exercise. It's beautiful. And it's, you know, and you meet some really interesting people. I mean, despite the, you know, sort of the negatives of some of the class, weird class things, but you meet some people who have done some really incredible things with their lives, and you have like normal conversations with them about the things, the kind of things that they do sometimes, and that's really interesting. And I enjoy being able to play one of the nicest golf clubs in the country for free whenever, you know, more or less whenever I want. I enjoy doing it.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right. Alex Jacobson, everybody. Thank you.
Safe ride home.
All right. What is this drink going to be called?
Caddy Masa.
Oh, wait. Sit down. A caddy.
Caddy Masa.
A caddy Masa?
Master.
A caddy master. Sorry. A caddy master. And a what?
Sharpshooter.
Sharpshooter.
Because
it's sharp. The spite and divot. Wow. All right.
Red ant.
Red ant.
It's been taken. It's actually a very, very important cocktail in the last 5 years. I'm sorry.
And now he's going to have to kill you with an umbrella. Okay, we have the Buck 05. We have the spite and divot. We have the sharpshooter. We have... Pepper Che? Ah. Wait. Pepper Che? Okay. Sharpshooter, Pepper Che, Spite and Divot, Buck 05. Oh my god, this is a lot.
Lime suds.
What?
Lime suds.
Lime suds. Okay. The bridge over troubled water. Wow, that was a lot. All right.
Lime on fire.
Lime on fire.
Burn your bridges.
Okay. There was one from this side, wasn't there? No. All right, they're all from this side. Okay, so you guys, yeah, you guys probably, like me, had too many to think of. All right, we should have an elimination round, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Have everybody call it out.
But what is calling it out going to come? Oh, yes, good idea. Our next host will be Claire Lehman. All right, so call out one at a time, starting from the left. Cut that with pride. Buck 05. Right, okay. Moving on.
She didn't vote for it.
Okay, moving on. What was yours? Lime on fire. Right. Okay. Yeah, these are the same, like, okay, Spite and Divot. All right, that's enough to get in the round. Spite and Divot is one. You're keeping track of this, right? Sharpshooter. Okay.
All right.
Bridge over troubled waters. All right. Okay. And then there were... What?
Pepper chin.
It's your mom. You going to vote for it? Yeah, all right. Good. This is like you versus you. Anything else?
Yes.
Lime suds. What? Lime
suds? Lime suds. Wasn't
one about like...
It was Caddy Master.
The Caddy Master. The Caddy Master. All right. Okay, so we've got it down to Caddy Master.
Caddy Master, Sharpshooter, Pepper Chin, Lime on Fire,
yeah.
And Sharpshooter.
And Spite and Divot. Sorry, this is really unwieldy. It's all right. Okay, so votes for Spite and Divot. Who's counting? One. 16. Okay, going to be hard to beat Spite and Divot. Bridge over troubled waters. Caddy Master, which I really like.
12.
Okay, Sharpshooter. Pepper. What? Two. Pepper Shea?
Pepper Shea.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5. All right. And we're missing one. Again. Are we not?
Bridge.
Lime of Fire. Was that it? Lime of Fire. So are we missing any? Anybody we did not account for? Okay. Well, in that case, it's a Spite and Divot. So I hope you all enjoyed yours. Thank you guys for coming. We'll see you at some time in the future, probably the fall.
Have a great summer, everyone.